So let's start today's session. We have Dr. Wolfgang Wieland from Perimeter Institute, and he will be speaking to us about covariant loop quantum gravity as a topological field theory with defects. Over to you, Doctor.
Thank you very much, and I would also like to thank Jorge Pullin for the opportunity and for all the organizers for speaking here at this international phone conference. Before I start, let me also ask you if everyone can hear me, because we had the last time some technical difficulties.
Yes, we can hear you.
Yeah. Thank you.
We can hear you.
So let's go to the slide number one, the first slide, where I speak about the basic idea. During the last couple of years, I think a new picture has emerged in loop quantum gravity that suggests a certain direction, namely that loop quantum gravity can be understood as a topological field theory with defects. There are several versions of this idea around in the literature right now, and they are distinguished in a certain sense by different kind of defects that are used to describe the degrees of freedom of the loop quantum gravity phase space. In fact, one can think of curvature defects, so where the gravitational field is described by configurations that are everywhere flat, except at certain one-dimensional line defects, for instance, or area defects, where the metric itself is everywhere vanishing, except at typically two-dimensional surfaces, or defects that carry even torsion as well. And the goal of this talk is to study in a systematic way the all class of these models in some unified framework, however, a completely classical framework also, that could then serve as a starting point for the quantization program. So let us go to the next slide, slide number three, where I speak about possible hints that show us that such a picture may indeed be realized in loop quantum gravity. The first hint for this comes from a paper by Eugenio, which has then led to several developments in the field, especially by Laurent Friedel and Mark Geiler and Jonathan Zybrick. Now, what they have observed is that the standard loop quantum gravity phase space on a fixed graph can be instead represented or thought of as the quantization of a topological field theory with defects on a three manifold. The idea on which, for instance, Eugenio's paper is based is the following. So take a three manifold, so like a Cauchy slice in your in your spacetime, and then you introduce a simplicial decomposition or a cellular decomposition of your three manifold sigma. And then you remove from this three manifold the one skeleton of this cellular decomposition. The resulting manifold is not anymore simply connected. In fact, there are non-contractible paths, which are exactly those loops that go once around this one-dimensional defect. And these are, and then the holonomies around these one-dimensional loops will turn into the fundamental degrees of freedom that you want to quantize. In fact, what has been shown is that, so this is now the first equation on this slide, that the loop quantum gravity inner product restricted, so the Ashteka-Lewandowski measure restricted to a fixed graph gamma, so a spin network graph gamma, can be understood at the same time as a formal Lebesgue measure over all connections times a constraint, delta F of A, which imposes that the curvature vanishes everywhere in sigma star. So everywhere except on this one dimensional line defects. Now to make this measure well defined, you have to follow a Fadeev-Popov procedure such that the measure is independent on the way you impose this constraint. In fact, psi of A is a gauge fixing function and delta Fadeev-Popov of psi is the corresponding functional determinant. In the example that that he gave Eugenio, but in fact in general, you can actually compute this functional determinant explicitly, and what it leads to is precisely the Ashtika-Lewandowski measure restricted to this Graf-Hilbert space. And this is a strong indication that loop quantum gravity, the loop quantum gravity phase space can indeed be thought of as the phase space of a topological field theory with defects. So this is all about the holonomy, so about the connection. But if you look now at the classical limit, or the semi-classical limit of the electric field, so the momentum conjugate to the connection, you find as well that the corresponding classical configurations are distributional. In fact, the electric field is supported only along a link, dual two-dimensional phase. Now, this has then been further developed, and it, in particular by Bianca Dietrich and Mark Geiler, who used these ideas to define, in fact, a new vacuum, which is a state that corresponds to F equals zero everywhere. So there are no defects at all. And then the idea is that that the excitations over this state are generated by excitations or acting with flux operators that create excitations over this vacuum. Another realization of this idea that loop quantum gravity is in fact a topological theory with defects is more explicitly realized in the isolated horizon framework, where you have a two surface which describes the horizon of your black hole, for instance, on which the spin network functions can end. And once they end on this two surface, they create punctures which carry curvature. And this is in fact, and everywhere else you have on this two surface, you have no degrees of freedom. So all the physical degrees of freedom on this two surface, which is the horizon, are generated by the insertions of spin network functions that puncture this two sphere. So let us go to the fourth slide, where I would like to say that there are now basically two different paths how to realize such an idea concretely. The first of which is what I will speak about in this talk, is a covariance theory. So now we are looking at not at the spatial slice, but at the entire space-time M. And instead of introducing a cellular decomposition or a simplicial decomposition of space, we introduce a simplicial decomposition of the entire space-time. And then we don't remove one-dimensional lines, so the one skeleton, but rather the two skeleton. So in fact, I remove the entire collection. So if I work with a simplicial decomposition, I would have to remove the entire collection of triangles from the manifold. And then the classical configuration space of connections is in fact essentially is nothing but the moduli space of flat connections on this manifold, which is not anymore simply connected. And all the degrees of freedom are carried by the holonomy, so by the parallel transport around these non-contractible cycles. And the idea is now to identify the boundary of each of these cycles as word lines for loop quantum gravity area defects. And the idea is then to write down the simplest action for such a configuration of defects moving around these one-dimensional cycles. A similar idea, so now we come to point two, is in fact what Bianca and Mark are currently working on. So it's a bit similar, but at the same, different in the sense that it's a canonical theory, that is where the defects are one dimension lower, and everything is a spatial slice. And the question is then how this can be extended to a four-dimensional theory in the bulk. But I refer to the talk of Mark's talk to the details of this construction. So let's go to slide number five, the outline of this talk. So the main message will be that the BF action with additional simplicity constraints that impose the geometricity of the area elements can be written as a word line integral for defects. So each of these word lines represents a degree of freedom that is added to the theory, and everywhere else there's just a topological theory that carries no physical degrees of freedom at all. And the question is then how these two can be put together, how to couple these area defects to a topological field theory in the bulk. So the outline of the talk is, first of all, I review this construction of a word line action for area defects. This I have spoken already in previous talks in this seminar series, so I will be rather brief on this. And then I will outline and explain how and why such an action can be naturally coupled to a three-dimensional. Yes?
This is Musim. So I just want to make a comment here, is that I'm about your idea, realize this LQG as topological quantum field theory with defects. But in covariance theory, it is already concretely realized, right? As probably we all know, that this is realized as a trans-Simon theory with line defects by the work of myself and collaborating with Aldo and Hal Haggard. So exactly the defect is imposed in trans-Simon theory, and the area is precisely the defect, which is non-contractible cycle of Freeman. So this is already concretely realized.
Yeah, thank you for this remark. What I want to point out here is that what I'm presenting here is the construction of a classical framework. And then the question is how this is in a systematic way, and then the question is how this is related to four-dimensional general relativity, and this has of course not been established yet. Now, what you're referring to is in fact
also discussed in my paper with Aldo. We actually derived the trans-Simon framework by using BF theory with simplicity constraint and with cosmological constants. That is also described in my paper with Aldo and Hall.
Yeah, I don't question this. I will also refer to your work, and I think there is no tension or no let's just go I will come back to this point and I will also explain the differences to your framework. especially because it is constructed on the level of a single four simplex, while what I'm presenting here is a theory that works on the entire four-dimensional manifold, so it's not restricted to a single building block. So let's now go to slide number six. So now we are looking at the word line action for area defects. Yes.
Sorry. Well, just try to correct what you just said. Generalizing to arbitrary many of forcing pieces in the framework of Chen Simon also has been done. It's already published.
If I can introduce perspective here, I don't think we should be squabbling about this kind of thing, because if we really look into it, these ideas are much older. I think it's just beautiful to see the different ways that these old ideas are worked out.
Okay, thanks.
So let's come to the slide number seven. So again, the construction principle is the very same as what we always have in spin foams. So we start from the BF action, which is a topological action, and which is written down in equation one. So it's pi alpha beta wedge F alpha. So the Lagrangian of the theory is the pi alpha beta wedge F alpha beta of A, where pi alpha beta is an SO13 value 2 form, taking values in the Lie algebra of the Lorentz group, and F alpha beta is the curvature tensor of the SO13 connection A alpha beta. Now, this action is, of course, topological, so it does not represent general relativity, but the point is that it has the very same kinematical structure. In fact, the symplectic structure of this action is essentially the symplectic structure of general relativity. But to get back to general relativity, we have to add constraints that impose that sigma alpha beta, so the which is again an SO3 value 2 form, is simple. That it is of the form E wedge E, or also star wedge E wedge E, where E alpha is the tetrad, which diagonalizes the four-dimensional metric tensor. And if sigma alpha beta is simple, so it's of the form as written down in equation 3, equation 1 is an action for general relativity without a cosmological constant, and the resulting theory is in fact GR. So the construction principle is now to take the action 1, so to start with the topological action, discretize it over a simplicial lattice, and add the discretized simplicity constraints, so equation 2, to the discretized BF action. And this can be then written as indeed a word line action for area defects. And let's go to slide number 8, where I briefly illustrate how such a simplicial discretization looks like. So it consists of four simplices, one of which I've drawn on the left, which are glued over between bounding tetrahedra. Now, in the as I explained on one of the previous slides, all the physical degrees of freedom in the connection are in the non-contractible cycles. So, what are these non-contractible cycles? Well, it's for them to see. It's better so to realize them. It's better to think in the dual picture. In fact, if you have a simplicial discretization, you can also work with the dual, in which every four simplex is dual to a point, to a vertex, every tetrahedron is dual to an edge, and every triangle in the simplicial discretization is dual to a two-dimensional face. Now, once I remove the triangles from the four-dimensional manifold, I get a manifold M star, which is not anymore simply connected. And all the non-contractible cycles are precisely the loops that go over the boundary of each phase. So the boundary of each of these dual phases in the discretization is precisely one of these non-contractible cycles. And the action that I write down will be an action which is an integral, a line integral over this boundary. And it is written in equation 4. Now the construction, so which is on the next slide, slide number 9. Now the construction of this action I have already explained at many different occasions. So instead of reviewing the derivation of this action from discretized BF, let me just state it. So on the left of equation 4, you have the discretized BF action. And on the right, you see that this discretized action is indeed a sum of all phases, where each phase contributes a one- and two-dimensional integral to the complete, to the total action. The first integral is a boundary integral, where the spinors pi a and omega a are just contracted. Now D, capital D, is a covariant derivative with respect to the self-dual Ashtekar connection. The spinors pi and omega, they have a geometric interpretation, and I will come back to this on the next slide. In fact, they diagonalize the self-dual part of the simplicial fluxes, of the simplicial area element, so of pi alpha beta, the two form pi alpha beta integrated over each triangle. Now, this connection, this action has further ingredients. Small a is in fact again a connection which I have to introduce to maintain a certain gauge symmetry which comes from the from a certain scaling ambiguity in the spinors. Finally, B is a Lagrange multiplier that tells you that this auxiliary U1 connection, or U1C, rather U1C connection, is in fact flat. And this is precisely the statement of the flatness of the connection in BF theory. So what is now the geometric interpretation of these variables, especially of the spinors? So let's go to explain this to slide number, to the next slide. Slide number 10. So it says slide number 9, but it's slide number 10. So we are now speaking about the geometric interpretation of the spinors. So we started from BF, which is just the integral over pi alpha beta, which the curvature tensor. Now, to discretize the action, what you typically do is you integrate the two-form pi alpha beta over the triangles dual to the two-dimensional faces, thus obtaining SO13 Lie algebra element pi f alpha beta for each phase. This definition contains additional holonomies that are required to make the definition of the integrated fluxes, the integral of pi alpha beta manifestly gauge invariant. So in order not to, so we introduce these holonomies HF of A in order to maintain local gauge invariants. Now this integrated flux is now an SO13 Lie algebra element, which is the same as to say it's an SL2C Lie algebra element, because the two Lie algebras are isomorphic. In fact, we can work with the self-dual representation in which we, so now we are in equation 7, in which I project pi alpha beta into its self-dual and anti-self-dual parts. Pi AB is in fact nothing but the self-dual component of the two of pi alpha beta. Now, this is just a matrix. A and B are spinor indices, and it can always be diagonalized. In fact, there are always two spinors, omega A and pi B, which diagonalize this flux. And in the action that I've written down on the left slide, on the last slide, these are precisely the fundamental degrees of freedom of the theory, which turn out to be canonical conjugate variables. So pi and omega are canonical conjugate. Now, they are defined as the eigenvectors of a matrix, these spinors, which means that there is a scaling ambiguity. So if pi and omega are spinors that diagonalize the flux, their rescaled the rescaled spinors will again be diagonalizing pi AB. And this is a gauge symmetry, in fact, of the theory. And to take care of the gauge symmetry, what you do is you have to add this additional U1 or this complexified U1 connection little a on each of the phases. Now we go to slide number 10. So what I've done so far is I've just rewritten the BF action, so the topological BF action for the Lorentz group as a line integral over spinors with some where the differentials are taken with respect to some connection. Now, this action is turns out to be topological, and to get back to GR, what we have to do is to add the simplicity constraints. So now we are on slide number 10, and the simplicity constraints tell you that the two-form sigma alpha beta is simple, and which is written in equation 9. So this constraint imposes the simplicity of sigma alpha beta. Now in the discretized theory, we work instead with the linear simplicity constraints, which are much easier to handle. In fact, they impose that for every tetrahedron in the discretization, there exists an internal future-oriented four-vector n alpha, such that the fluxes through the four bounding triangles of this tetrahedron are simple, which means that they are annihilated by the integrated flux. Now, if I write this, now for each triangle, these are three equations. Now the spinors, they in fact diagonalize the fluxes. So I can equally well write equation 10, the linear simplicity constraints, in terms of the spinors. And what I then get on each phase are again three constraints, but now they are written in terms of the spinors. The first equation, 11a, turns out to be Lorentz invariant, while 11b is invariant only on under the transformations that preserve n a bar, where this is the normal, the internal normal in spinor space. And in notice also that in equation 11, this is in fact the only equation where the immersive parameter actually appears in the theory, in this simplicity constraint.
Can I just ask a question?
Yes, please.
So in 11A, as you just mentioned, that we got the parameter beta. But, I mean, since you are looking at self-dual connections and so on, it would be natural to just look at beta equal to plus or minus I. And, you know, because the whole framework could be done in that way. And my question really is, if you consistently keep self-dual as opposed to anti-self-dual, whatever connection you are using here, if you consistently keep that, then is beta equal to I or minus I? If it is minus I, then that constraint doesn't make any sense. And if it is plus I, then, of course, you know, it just becomes half. So that is a question.
Yes, I understand. So this question, so what you're saying is that for beta equal minus I, the first term, equation 11a is just mathematically not well defined. Now, this is true, in fact, but the reason why this happens is very simple, because what I've started with is an action that is real. So for any real action, beta is implicitly assumed to be real. Now to study the purely self-dual action, I would have to look at the complex action. And in that case, the simplicity, I could again write down the simplicity constraints, and they would impose simply the reality of the metric. And in that case, equation 11a, then imposes that the contraction of the spinors pi a omega a is either real or imaginary. I don't know it. I don't know it by heart. So it's just one of the two possibilities. So what I'm saying is to go to the poorly to a self-dual framework, what would you have to do is not taking naively the limit of beta to I in equation 11a, that wouldn't work, but you would just have to study the reality conditions on the metric and write them in terms of these spinors. And then what you then get is that pi a omega a, so the Lorentz invariant contraction of the spinors, is either real or poorly imaginary, one of the two. Okay, so in principle, you can still do this.
Thank you. Yeah.
So let's go to the point now of this slide is that by introducing the simplicity constraints, you have introduced an additional structure to this theory, namely this normal vector NA or NA A bar is a matrix in spinor space that enters the simplicity constraints. And the question or the real what makes everything so hard and difficult is to understand what is the geometric role of this normal in the theory. So is it a dynamical field? Is it a Lagrange multiplier, or is it just gauge? So this has to be clarified, and this is what I will speak now on slide number 11. In fact, what I think is most natural is to think of this normal as the pullback of a one-form to the boundary of each phase. So remember, the action that I've defined is just a word line integral to the along the boundary of each phase in the discretization. And if we take now this action and add the simplicity constraints, we have to understand what is the geometric role of this normal in this new action. Is it does it appear as a Lagrange multiplier, or is it rather just an additional field? And what I want to push forward is to say that this normal is in fact nothing but the pullback of one form E alpha, which plays in fact the role of the tetrad on the boundary of each phase. So the action that I then find, so let's go right away to equation 12, consists of the following slide number 12, sorry. So the action that I then propose consists of the following terms. So first of all, we have just the original discretized BF action, which is what I have written down in red. So the first term is just a covariant derivative of the spinors contracted such that the whole expression is Lorentz invariant, plus additional terms in the bulk, so an integral over F that imposes the flatness of the connection, hence imposes that the curvature is flat. So this is just discretized BF. Now we go to slide number 13, where I have marked in blue now the constraints that I've added to the theory. So these are just the simplicity constraints that I imposed on the configuration variables of this action. And then there are certain Lagrange multipliers. So now we are on slide 14 in green, which impose the simplicity constraints. So the linear simplicity constraints. And now the point is to figure out what is the geometric role or what is E? So what is E alpha? And what should be its dynamics in this theory? Because now we have added an additional degree of freedom, so we have to explain what is it. So we have to find a way to determine its dynamics. So to this we go to over slide 16 to slide number 16, which is background fields in the action. So the action that I've just constructed depends now on additional configuration variables, which appear in fact like as background fields in the theory. They are the self-dual connection A hiding in the covariant derivative D, which appears in the symplectic potential for the spinors, pi A, D, omega A. But then there's also this auxiliary tetrad, E alpha, or EA, A bar in spinor space. And the idea is now that I want to push for that these fields A and E, that they should be in fact treated as dynamical fields as well. So what we should do is to take this action that I've defined on this slide and couple it to a field theory for A and E. But of course we can build many, many field theories out of a connection and the tetrad, but we want only those that are topological, because the philosophy or the strategy is that all physical degrees of freedom are only captured by these word line defects. And everything else is just a topological field theory. And the topological field theory that I'm searching for is one that is only built from the one forms A and E. So now let's go to slide number 17. So normally, in a spin form, we think of the phases in the simplicial, in the spin form or in the dual of the simplicial decomposition as meeting in one-dimensional edges, which lie just on the boundary of each phase. But if we think of an isolated horizon, for instance, this picture gets already generalized. In fact, on an isolated horizon, which describes the horizon of a black hole, for instance, the spin network links, they don't anymore end up in a single point, in an intertwiner. They end up on a two-dimensional surface, which they puncture. And this two-dimensional surface in an isolated horizon, it carries no physical degrees of freedom. The field theory that we put on there is just topological. And all the physical degrees of freedom of an isolated horizon, for instance, are just generated by the punctures that end on these two surfaces. So indeed, it seems natural to take this lesson seriously and apply it also to spin forms, in fact. And then the idea would be to smear out the edges of the discretization and replace it by tubes, which have the topology of a two-sphere, S2, times just R. So what you end up is the image on the right-hand side, where you have a number of two-dimensional phases F that can now end on a whirl tube, which represents the time evolution of your two surfaces. And one of the advantages of such a formulation, I think, would be that it would automatically remove all point-like interactions in a spin form, which are then just smeared out and become and completely disappear. And this would make the theory in every small neighborhood look like just a free theory of topological field theory coupled to a word line. Word lines that never intersect anymore. And so locally this theory would be completely free. And all the non-triviality and all the dynamics would be in how these surfaces glue together. So how can this be made, this general idea, this structure, be made more concretely? So let's go to slide number 18. Now, the goal is now to write down an action for these background fields A and E, such that the entire system, so the coupled theory, doesn't have anymore any background fields and is completely background independent. So how do we do this? Well, we don't want to write down any action that depends on a connection and a tetrad, but one that is indeed topological. And the simplest action that is topological that we can build out of the connection and the tetrad is in fact a Chern-Simons action, which is the first term coupled to E veg DE. So E alpha veg DE alpha, where DE alpha is in fact the torsion. So if you look at the equations of motion for this action, you find that they are very simple. In fact, the variation with respect to E tells you that the exterior covariant derivative of the tetrad on the three surface M vanishes, while from the variation of the action with respect to the SO13 connection, you find that the curvature tensor is of the form of a de Sitter curvature. The coupling constants are lambda and alpha, and the ratio lambda over alpha plays the role of a cosmological constant on the three surface M. But now I put this under quotation marks because it is not at all clear that this constant has indeed the interpretation of a cosmological constant for the full theory. It appears like one on this three surface, but whether it is the actual physically cosmological constant that we would assign to a four-dimensional geometry, this I don't know. Furthermore, you can write this action on the three surface M just as a Chern-Simons action for a larger gauge group. In fact, for SO14, respectively SO23, depending on the sign of this auxiliary cosmological constant. And then the gauge symmetries, so the local SOPQ gauge symmetries on this three surface, they're in fact nothing but semi-direct product of diffeomorphisms times local transformations. Furthermore, this action is already very similar to what we have in the literature. In fact, it is essentially if you drop the Chern-Simons term, so if you set the coupling constant alpha to zero, the second term, if you look at its Hamiltonian formulation, yields precisely the boundary symplectic structure that you have on an isolated horizon. In fact, Laurent Freidel and Alejandro Perez have recently considered a very similar model where they only have this second term on the three surfaces. Furthermore, I can now come back to the comment of Mushin Han at the beginning of my talk. Indeed, this action also incorporates the model of Hallhagert, Mushin Han, Wojtek Kaminski and Riello. In fact, it corresponds to the limit where lambda is zero, while alpha is kept fixed. And now similar models have been also studied earlier, including myself in 2011. So far we have just defined an action. An action that defines, that consists of a three-dimensional topological field theory on the horizon, so on these extended intertwiners, and an additional world line integral for each of the defects that we add to this action. Now that we have defined this action, the question is, yes?
I have a question about this action. So you said, as far as I understand, your A alpha beta is an SO13 connection. That's right, right?
That's right.
And so you have two terms. So I think what you want to do is to complexify this A to make A plus IE, for example, to be a complex connection. That's what you say about enlarged.
I know precisely what you mean. So what Mushin is referring to is that one could also study a different action where you set lambda to zero, and in the first term you use the fact that there are two ways to build invariance in the Lie algebra of the Lorentz group. One is just contraction by the identity, the other one is contraction by the epsilon tensor. And this would give you then two coupling constants. Now, indeed, I have also considered this case, but what I then found is that the resulting equations of motion, if you want lambda, so little lambda in the definition of the action to not vanish, you can only have a topological theory constructed both of A and E that is of the form that I'm giving here in this action. So what you're saying, Mushin, would not be any more a topological theory as soon as you set lambda to as soon as you allow lambda to be non-vanishing. So the only what I'm saying is that the only topological theory that you can build out of A and E is the one that I'm writing down in this line.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking that you can make a complex gauge connection and write it a transient action with complex gauge connection and with complex coupling as well. That is also, that's definitely topological, just like a complexified SO13 transient theory. Which includes your cases.
No, but you don't include the case where lambda is non-vanishing. That's the point.
But alpha is complex.
Yeah, but that's right. But what I'm saying is that you can construct topological field theory out of A and E. So if you want to have both fields on the boundary, then you can construct a topological field theory only if alpha and lambda are real, unless lambda is zero, in which case you have the possibility to contract with two invariants in the definition of the transiemann's action, and then you get indeed two coupling constants. And if you then write the action into itself in terms of its self-dual and anti-self-dual decomposition, they turn into complex coupling constants, as you were saying. But this is possible only if lambda vanishes, so little lambda. But you don't want to have this, and then the only topological field theory that you can construct out of A and E is the one that I'm giving. So we can discuss this, I can explain this to you in more detail, but for the moment, let's just continue. So so now we have the following setup. So we have a three-dimensional topological SOPQ Chern-Simons theory on the boundary, which is coupled to line defects that that carry certain spinors. And now the question is how the entire system evolves. So what are the equations of motion for the coupled system, and are they consistent? So are they solvable? And this brings me to the last point of this talk, where I speak about integrability conditions. So let's go to slide number 20. So if we now vary this action, we find that the curvature of this SOPQ connection is not anymore vanishing. In fact, it has some non-trivial distributional sources wherever there is a defect. In fact, the torsion, so which is the covariant exterior derivative of the tetrad, is sourced by the by a four-vector that can be constructed out of the spinors, and equally well, the Sitter curvature F alpha F A B minus E veg E is sourced by the symmetrized tensor product of the spinors at each defect. The point is now that 13A and 13B, they are not the only equations of motion that you generate by varying the action. In fact, on each of the insertions, there is every word line comes with its own action, and we not only have to take into account the variation of the action on the three-dimensional horizon, we have to take into account the variation of the word line action itself. And what it gives us is written in equation 14. The equations of motion have a simple Hamiltonian form, so the covariant time derivative of the spinors is generated by a Hamiltonian, which is given in equation 15, which is, notice, just quadratic in the fundamental spinors. So the Hamiltonian that generates the time evolution of these spinors is just a covariant contraction of all spinors, but they appear only to second order, so only quadratic. And the Poisson brackets are very simple. They just tell you that pi and omega are canonical conjugate variables. Notice that this theory is, in a sense, real. So you have Poisson brackets for both the spinors pi and omega, but also of their complex conjugate. If you would work with a purely self-dual theory, so if you would set the immersive parameter to I, you would only have one of them, essentially. This brings me back to the question of Abai.
Sorry, can you comment on the form of the Hamiltonian? What is AB? What is Xi? Why this Hamiltonian? What does it mean?
Ah, okay. So this Hamiltonian is consists of two terms. The first term is T is the vector field along the so it's the tangent vector of your word line, which carries the insertion of this, which describes the insertion of the defect into your three manifold. A sub B is this additional auxiliary connection that I've added to maintain the gauge invariance in the spinors, so this gauge connection is so the spinors, they are unique up to complex rescalings, up to conformal transformations, if you wish, and the connection a little b, it it is just needed to make the to maintain this gauge invariance. Now the second term, theta is one of the Lagrange multipliers that imposes the
under a gauge transformation in transformed by a derivative, so this Hamiltonian is gauge dependent.
No, on the left-hand side of equation 14, there is a covariant derivative.
So AB is the connection.
Yes.
So TBAB is a gauge-dependent.
TBAB is a gauge-dependent quantity, but also the derivative itself is gauge-dependent. So both, so the derivative d over dt also changes under gauge, and the two just...
It's a covariant derivative.
Yeah, therefore it's independent of the of your gauge.
A covariant derivative is not gauge dependent by definition.
No, but is, this is sitting, in addition to this, there's the symplectic structure on the world line, which is omega pi dot. This together with that is covariant.
No, because p omega, pi omega is not real. Unless you have that pi omega is real.
So pi a omega a satisfies a reality condition, yeah. But I don't see why this is related to...
Well, it's very important. Because AA transform on the gauge transformation. Your Hamiltonian cannot be, has to be invariant in the gauge transformation.
Yes, but it... Because
so Lee is giving an argument why it's going to be invariant. If it's not invariant, it doesn't make...
It has to be a reality condition for that to work. Right.
So the reality condition is the condition that this Hamiltonian is gauge invariant. It's not...
Yeah, you could say this in that way. Yeah, so what you have in equation 14 is the Hamiltonian that generates the dynamics of the spinors. Now, the additional constraints that come from the variation of the Lagrange multipliers, which are precisely these terms that appear in front of pi a omega a. So ta contracted with the connection little a is one of the Lagrange multipliers, and this variation yields an additional constraint, which is just what we call in the spinorial formalism, the area matching condition. So in the and then we have to check, of course, whether all these constraints are preserved under the time under this Hamiltonian flow, and this gives then secondary constraints and integrability conditions, which I come to now in equation 21. In fact, what you find is, or what I find is. So we are now in equation 17. So what Laurent was mentioning was that once you have defined these equations of motion, you have to check whether they are internally consistent. So to run the Dirac procedure and check whether the system is integrable. Now, in fact, they are essentially just the Bianchi identities. So what you have to check is that the exterior covariant derivative of the curvature tangent is zero, and the exterior covariant derivative of the torsion 2 form is vanishing as well. Now, this is now a non-trivial condition because F alpha beta and T alpha, so the curvature and torsion, they have non-trivial sources. And for equation 17 to be satisfied, this leads to some integrability conditions on your variables. And what I find is, so these are in a sense secondary constraints, if you wish. And what I find is the constraints in 18a and 18b, in fact, the Lagrange multiplier that imposes one of the simplicity constraints, theta, has some non-trivial dynamics where this additional connection A enters, but then also, and this is quite unexpected, and I don't at the moment I don't understand its its physical significance, I also find that this coupling constant lambda, which was the ratio of the two coupling constants in the Trans-Siemens action on the three boundary, must have a definite sign. In fact, it must be negative, which means that the local gauge group on the on your three surface must be of the anti-de Sitter type, so SO23. We go to slide number 22. Now you may ask, how can I recover what I have in just ordinary loop quantum gravity, where all these spheres shrink to points? And what we have there is, of course, the Gauss law. So how does the Gauss law appear in this in this new formulation? Well, as I have explained, each of the defects creates a source, a distributional source for curvature and torsion. Now, curvature and torsion in this formalism, they are just the components of the SO14 curvature tensor on the three surface, on this horizon. In fact, out of E and A, you can easily construct a de Sitter connection, which is which is written on the bottom of this page. So Aij sub A, so the de Sitter connection, it is a linear combination of the SO13 connection plus a translation P mu, and the algebra of the generators is given on the right-hand side. So in particular, the commutator of two P mu's gives again an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, which is precisely the local algebra, the algebra of the symmetry generators of the de Sitter group. And now we can immediately recover the Gauss law. In fact, we go to equation 20 to the next slide and look at equation 21. So consider now a disk on the two surface S2, where all these punctures end, that goes once around all of these defects. Then you can study the holonomy around this loop. Now this holonomy is contractible to the identity, hence it's the parallel transport around this loop must be 1. So it must be the identity in the de Sitter group. And but now we can employ the non-abelian Stokes theorem and write the integral, so the path ordered integral over the boundary of this disk as a surface ordered integral of the curvature tensor integrated over the interior of this disk. Now the curvature tensor, so the components of the de Sitter curvature, F alpha beta and P alpha, are sourced by the spinors. So they are sourced by some currents, JA, J alpha beta and J alpha. Now in the limit where the where this auxiliary cosmological constant goes to zero, this path ordered product of group elements turns in fact into just a sum over the Lie algebra elements. And so in the limit where we can just look at the first order of this of equation 21, we get the usual Gauss law, namely that the sum of all j's vanishes. So sum over j alpha beta over E is 0, which is the usual SO13 Gauss law. But then there is an additional Gauss law, which has so far been ignored, which is the a conservation law for the currents JA, that the sum of them must vanish on this two sphere. And let's now go to the to the conclusion. So I will then finish. So how to construct a spin form model out of that. So let's go to slide number 25. So the idea is now simply to just take a path integral representation where we integrate over all configuration variables. So the first integral would be path integral over the exponential of the SO14 Jean-Simons action weighted by the canonical measure for connection and tetrad. And then this SO14 Jean-Simons expectation value would be taken with certain insertions, namely the insertions of the word line integrals over each boundary of F, which is just the insertion of certain spinors or certain holonomies into your path integral. And this brings me to the last slide. So let me briefly summarize and conclude it. So first of all, I started with discretized BF and have shown that this discretized BF action can be written as a word line integral for certain spinors propagating along the edges of this discretization. These spinors have a geometric interpretation. They're in fact just the eigenvectors of the self-dual part of the simplicial fluxes. Then we added the simplicity constraints and to this discretized BF action. So we added the discretized simplicity constraints. The point is now that the linear simplicity constraints contain an additional variable, an additional configuration variable, which are these normals, which appear in the definition of the linear simplicity constraint. And the idea was that this normal is now should be viewed as a dynamical field. In fact, it should be viewed just as as the pullback of a tetrad to these one-dimensional word lines. And then the proposal was to write down, to couple these defects to a topological field theory that is constructed from the SO13 connection A alpha beta and the tetrad E alpha. And the simplest, and I think in fact the only background, the only topological field theory that you can build out of E alpha and A alpha beta is in fact an SOPQ Jean-Simons theory. I then briefly discussed the equations of motion that you derive from the coupled system. So the equations of motion for this Jean-Simons theory coupled to these word line defects. And then the equations of motion are of two kinds. First of all, you get field equations on these three-dimensional word tubes that tell you that the Jean-Simons, that the De Sitter curvature is sourced by the spinors at the defects. But then these defects, or the spinors at these defects, they have some non-trivial dynamics themselves. And the two are consistent with each other only if the gauge group is SO14 rather than SO23. Now, whether this coupling constant that appears in the definition of this SO14 Jean-Simons theory really has the interpretation of a cosmological constant or not, this I don't know. And this is probably one of the most important problems in this formalism. So what is the geometric significance of this coupling constants in the action? And I would like to stop here. Thank you very much.
Questions?
I have a question. So my previous question is clarified on your equation on page 22. So it's clear now. And my another question is about your equation 21, your closure condition. So we try to somehow do some reconstruction work to the geometrical interpretation of this closure, if it implies to some kind of tetrahedron geometry with torsion or something.
Yeah, thank you very much. This is in fact, so the question regarding 21 is really excellent. So this is is really one of the key questions, whether this geometry, whether the configurations on each of these two spheres still represents something like a geometric polyhedron. And in fact, I don't think that this is satisfied because in fact of the equations that are written above equation 21. So what you see is that there is some non-vanishing torsion in this theory. Now we know, however, that so the geometric reconstruction of polyhedra out of the fluxes, this precisely relies on the vanishing of torsion, because only then can you interpret the integrated fluxes as oriented area elements of a polyhedra. Only if torsion is vanishing do the simplicial fluxes have a geometric interpretation in terms of area elements of a polyhedron. As soon as you turn on torsion, the closure constraint is violated. So you lose this idea the flux, for instance, if you have if you would have a tetrahedron, the fluxes through each of the four triangles would not anymore sum up to zero. So you would lose the geometric interpretation of this of this tetrahedron or of these fluxes as describing the area elements of a triangle, but this is not bad or inconsistent. In fact, as soon as you would, for instance, put a fermion inside a polyhedron, you would also get that the closure constraint is not anymore satisfied. In fact, the Gauss law would get a source term, which is proportional to the spin of the particle in this tetrahedron. And so the answer is most probably no, or only in very special cases would these fluxes, J alpha beta, still correspond to a geometric tetrahedron. So thank you for this question.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question about physical interpretation?
Please go ahead.
Yes, so if you look on your last slide, the slide 25, where you have the full path integral, there are two coupled systems, the systems on the faces, F, and the systems on the three manifolds, M. And each of them, if they weren't coupled, each of them would be solvable. And so the non-trivial dynamics comes from the coupling, which is in the action on the faces and the way the A's and E's come into the action on the faces. So are there any interesting limits or approximations in which something analogous to a semi-classical expansion, in which one takes the limit of H bar small and extracts a semi-classical equation in which one of the terms of the other dominate?
Yeah, so what I would like to look at is in fact the limit where these surfaces are in a certain sense small. So where these two spheres have shrink down to a point, in which case you would this deformed Gauss law would bring you back to the to the original Gauss law of loop quantum gravity, where there is no torsion, in fact.
And well, would that correspond to just representing it by a quantum deformed intertwiner?
This is what I expect, indeed. Yeah, that in quantum theory, these intertwiners, so the loop quantum gravity intertwiners that we have at each node of a spin network, would be most probably replaced by some deformed intertwiners. Now, this can be made rigorous certainly if the gauge group is compact and SO2 rather than SO1 1 3. How this is true for the non-compact case, I don't know, and maybe Aldo knows or works on this. I don't know. But what I would also like to say is it would be interesting whether this limit where these spheres shrink to zero, where the horizon, in a sense, disappears, whether this can be modeled by a certain limit of these coupling constants appearing in the action on the horizon. That would be also interesting.
Right, that's what I was thinking is a large level. Your little lambda is like the level of the non-compact Schoen-Simon, and there'll be a limit when it becomes very big, which is like small h bar.
Yeah, I have also thought about this, but I don't have anything concrete to say at the moment about this problem. It would be very, very nice if that works out like you are suggesting, that one can get an ordinary spin form model completely undeformed, where all these spheres are essentially where all these spheres shrink down to a point by just taking a certain limit in the Chern-Simons action. That would be very good indeed, but I don't have this at the moment. But also the philosophy is here just to more like explore the general theory space that we can build out of these out of these variables that we naturally have at our disposal. So we are working with the discretized theory, where the discretized action we can naturally write down as this word line integral. Now this action comes with certain fields. And now the question is, what is the natural action that we can couple these fields to? And it seems that what I presented is, at least seems to me, as one of maybe the most reasonable possibility. But there may be others.
Wolfgang, I'm just continuing along the questions that have been discussed so far. So if I go up to your slide 27, which is the last slide.
Yes.
So, I mean, one begins with kind of classical theory, which is general relativity, and one wants to understand what is a quantum theory, whose correct quantum theory, so to say, whose classical limit is general relativity. And then one has done sort of a series of explorations and assumptions, right? And it seems to me that at each stage, one goes further away. And therefore, the connection of the resulting structure to general relativity or to kind of real world, if you like, to the fact that people have actually detected gravitational waves, gets more and more obscure. So, I mean, to me at least, it looks like it is fascinating mathematical physics, but is this really, does it have anything much to do with the degrees of freedom that we normally associate with gravity? So for example, you know, in your second bullet, you are saying that gravity is a constraint topological theory. We assume the same holds for the discretized theory. So there's an assumption. Then we propose to blow up. I mean, these are all mathematical physics natural constructions. I quite agree with that. But at the end of the day, I get some structure, and I don't see anywhere why this theory, in what limit, in some appropriate limit, is going to have two transverse traceless degrees of freedom. If I were looking at kind of fluctuations around some reasonable semi-classical background. I think when you were here and we were doing this thing, this was at the stage 1 and 2, and you had not blown it up. Already at that stage, when we tried to do these degrees of freedom and, you know, how many polarizations or how many we have, I mean, we couldn't really find two. I mean, it seemed to be there were at least three or something. So my question really is, what does this have to do with the original problem? And so maybe you have some intuition in mind or concrete result in mind, which is, however, not completely rigorous, which gives us some confidence that this has something to do with quantum general relativity or quantum gravity.
Yes, thank you. And indeed, I also have the same concern, of course. But so what motivates me or trusts me that this may in the end truly describe general relativity plus corrections is that what you started with, and also that the theory that you end up with at the end, it has it is a theory of geometry of indeed the very same kinematical degrees of freedom that appear in the in Einstein's actions. So you have a tetrad and essentially a tetrad and a connection, and then you say that all the physical degrees of freedom are generated by some defects. Now, of course, it is not clear that this is is just GR or GR plus some higher curvature corrections. This I don't know, but that you started from a field theory that is essentially from a field content. So the field content is essentially just the same as GR. What is different is that all the possible degrees of freedom are captured only by insertions of defects. So at the moment, this is the only true hint that this gives that this has something to do with GR. But I think that this can be made much more rigorous. And in fact, if you look at the work of Aldo and Mushin, for instance, you find that the corresponding quantum amplitudes are indeed, at least on as far as I understand, on the single four-simplex level, are indeed peaked on classical configurations that correspond to curved polyhedra. So there is, although there are all these steps and implicit assumptions, there is a guiding principle that gives you that seems to lead you to something which is geometry and hence gravity. And the guiding principle is to make as little assumptions as possible and keep the theory background independent and add all physical degrees of freedom only in a finite number of defects. Yeah.
I mean, I think the first philosophy, I think, is perfectly understandable, attractive, that everything is concentrated at these defects. But after all, that was also the idea of Reggie calculus, right? I mean, it's not kind of completely new, but it's fine with me. But then one has many, many, many other steps, right? It's blowing up, right? Assuming that the same thing, that the BA plus simplicity holds also for the discretized theory and so on and so forth. And then my concern is basically the following, that in the 80s and 90s, right, I mean, it also seemed like we should just start with the background independent theory and then spin networks and quantum geometry, and everything arose very naturally, and sort of one feels that it has something to do with gravity. But then when it came to dynamics, which is what we're talking about here now, right, we had this Hamiltonian constraint, and then, I mean, at each stage one might say that, well, one did what was most natural, but then it was pretty clear that there were many, many, many ways of going about constructing the Hamiltonian constraint, and then we don't know if any of them corresponds to, I mean, the physics of it was not so clear. But by that I mean physics of it, not mathematical physics, but physics of it was not so clear. And that is where we sort of, you know, somehow I think we got more or less stuck there. And I'm concerned that maybe we are embarking the same thing with these more discrete models, right, or with spin forms or generalization of spin forms, etc. And so my concern is basically that unless at an early enough stage one makes some contact with physical problems, and I mean real contact, not just kinematical contact, right? That there may be just, I mean, just like this blowing up procedure. I mean, I agree it looks natural. Just as in the olden days, looking at the graph and looking at Hamiltonian constraints without adding in edges or adding the minimal number of edges or constructing a triangle for given any two edges, all those things very natural. So that is my concern. I just wanted to voice this. It doesn't mean that one should not work on these things, but I feel that that somehow physics perspective is not sufficiently kept into, I mean, qualitative physics, dynamical, everybody will tell you that, well, I mean, there is actually very good effective field theory for general relativity. I mean, we don't trust the Planck scale, but there is effective field theory. So at some scales, one theory should sort of make some contact there. And I kind of don't see any even avenue to do that. So these are my concerns. I'm not sort of, I just wanted to express it for the whole community, not just you. And I know that we discussed this many times.
Yeah, if I can add to this, the danger is that this theory, which is topological gravity with defects, is just in a different sector than the one where general relativity with smooth metrics and gravity lives. And two reasons to worry are that this theory is just a function of h bar times g and not separately of g, so there's no way, or it's very difficult to see how a Newtonian gravity, let alone general relativity, could emerge from it. And the other thing, which is that there has to be a notion of energy, which is bounded from below, to get us back to the real physics, and it's very hard to see how to do that. Although these spinners are very reminiscent, and I'm sure you're thinking of this, Wolfgang, of wind spinners.
I guess the way I understand Abai's question, question for you, it's really about the continuum limit. So now that we have this formulation, does that give us a handle on the continuum limit formulation, or part of the question of Abai is about the continuum limit? How do we relate? How does that help us? What's your view on that? Abai is complaining that this might be just another discrete theory, and we have many discrete theories, but we're struggling to understand what they mean, you know, in the continuum limit.
I mean, it doesn't have to be a continuum limit. It can be, you know, in a generalized sense, some sense in which it has.
Yeah, but at some point it has to be at some coarse grain. If you want to recover Einstein equation, you have to have a way to put
lots
of
some kind of coarse graining or something, you know.
And say that they, yes, that they kind of average themselves around Einstein equation.
Well, So one possibility is not to look at how to generate a continuum space-time, but rather look at local observables of GR, or quasi-local observables, like quasi-local energy, quasi-local angular momentum, things like this. And these can be, so there's a beautiful construction by Mason and Witten to construct quasi-local energy, for instance, as two-dimensional surface integrals over certain spinors. Now, this formalism that I presented here, it is tightly related to all this spinorial approach. In fact, the fundamental degrees of freedom of the theory that I presented here, they are just spinors. And now the one road to identify a relation to continuum GR is to identify these spinors that appear here with those that are used to introduce quasi-local charges in GR. And if one could show that, for instance, the algebra of observables that appears in this framework, so the algebra of quasi-local observables as surface integrals over a two-sphere is the same that appears in general relativity, or at least very close to it, then one would be again in good shape, I think, because then one would have a way to relate quasi-local constructions in one framework, so in this framework, with those that appear already in GR. And this could be a new way, I think, to think about this
something
problem.
Something along that line, right? I mean, as you know, but others may not, that in fact, the connection variables were first discovered in the spinorial framework, precisely because the spinorial geometry is so rich and so nice. But for example, you know, using the spinorial methods, one actually does prove positive energy theorems. So can one do something like that here, right? Is there a discrete analog? I mean, just as you emphasized, you're only looking at the classical theory. But so at this classical level, is there some analog of the positive energy theorem, for example? So take some ideas like that would be extremely helpful. And the second thing that also I feel that in the spin form picture as a whole, there is kind of too much of a reluctance to really come to grips with matter. And I know in the beginning, of course, it was completely understandable. But now the subject has been around for, you know, sufficiently long time that one should really look at matter. So same thing here, one should really understand matter.
Indeed. But maybe I should have added this to this talk. So what was it that always prevented, or what makes it hard for us in spin forms to couple matter? It is that the fundamental, so the metric is only encoded in a two form, in E match E, so we don't have the tetrad at our disposal, and in almost any Lagrangian that you write down for a matter field, what you crucially need is a metric and its inverse, typically, or at least the tetrad E alpha. And now, so in this formalism, I have introduced a tetrad on these 3D surfaces, and this tells me that there is at least the kinematical structure that I can use to couple a matter Lagrangian to this action. So that was also another motivation for introducing E alpha as a variable on its own.
Thank you very much. So, I just want to say that I find that it's a very beautiful piece of work. I mean, there's no question about it. But also the work that Mushin and other people are doing. But I think that we should just keep these other issues about physics in mind. That is the only thing. It's not that I'm complaining, as Laura says, but I feel that somehow we should keep that in mind, because otherwise we might again end up in the same similar situation as, you know, with the problems, the Hamiltonian constraint that we slowly realize. That's all I was saying. Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you.
More questions or comments? If not, let's thank the speaker once again.